Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We still have Glenn on the line. I don't know if he'll continue to chime in, but we're going to change our discussion back to Paul's letter so that we can continue to expose to those who are either Christians and therefore need to know that they have been lied to, that the author of half of their New Testament is a liar, and therefore their soul is going to pay price for having been deceived, should they not awaken to that fact. Or to those who are not religious, is the other reason we're continuing, because Christianity is so dominant in the West, and there's so many aspects of Christianity that are so irrational. You know, for example, the notion that you either love God in accordance with his edicts, or he's going to see to it that you're tortured forever in hell. That kind of a God's not lovable. Or this idea that the heavens and earth were created in 6 days, meaning 6,000 years ago, and the earth is only 6,000 years old. Or that that you've got a religion like Christianity whose most important holidays are Christmas and Easter, both of which are based upon the Babylonian religion. So there were just so many aspects of Christianity that are so upside down. You've got a the fullness of God, the completeness of God that's in a man. You know, that your God is so small that he fits within a man. That God is, the religious God is the micromanager that wants you to pray without ceasing, that's involved in every aspect of your life. Well, if that's the case, there's no such thing as free will. God's involved in minutia and ceases to be even interesting or relevant. And so there's just so many stupid aspects of the Christian religion that a lot of people just tune out God and say, I'm going to be an agnostic. I'm going to choose to ignore God because their religious depictions of him make him seem so ridiculous. Was that your background, Glenn, or what did you come from a more religious perspective?
Well, actually, I have a rather tempestuous, tumultuous personal history. I was raised as a garden variety suburban liberal Lutheran, with that. But then while in college, I did my Eastern, did the meditation thing and Eastern religion thing and bounced around there and stuff. Found myself back in evangelicalism and then a Pentecostal background. I graduated with a degree in biblical studies from a Pentecostal college.
Wow. So, okay. Yeah. Wow, that's the full McGillicuddy, because in Lutheranism, what you really have is an English version of Roman Catholicism. And it's a religion that is just stiflingly into to ritual, completely devoid of life.
It's funny, they're very politically conservative. First of all, the Anglican and Lutheran liturgies are almost identical now. The Anglican Protestants and the Lutherans are almost so completely on the same page they could practically recite each other's liturgies.
A Protestant version of Catholicism is what it is. I mean, it's everybody that I want the big organization, I want the structure. I don't bother me with an actual message. I want to be religious without having to think, but I really love the pomp and the ceremony and all that sort of thing. And that's kind of the Anglican and Lutheran mentality. It's Roman Catholic without being born Roman Catholic.
Well, societally, they're a wonderful group. I mean, because they're very clean cut, clean living, hardworking, family oriented people. You know what I mean? They pay their taxes. They tend to be politically, mildly conservative, but in values, moderately liberal. You know, they don't make an ounce of trouble in society. Is what, what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay. That's kind of like saying that the Amish are all clean cut and hardworking. I know. And of course, when you actually get to know Amish individuals or Mennonites, which is Amish light, and on our farm we have several Mennonites that work for us on our farm, and you know, the actual culture, because I've had two previous Mennonites that you know, I shared Yahweh's Torah and said God hates religion, and demonstrated to them that Christianity was false and that Yahweh actually has a covenant he'd like to participate in. And they have left the Mennonite religion, and they have become members of the covenant. And so they're more than willing to share the what really goes on behind the scenes. And it's like that Amish mafia program, I'm sure what it's dramatized. There is huge issues with all forms of Christianity, and underneath and lurking in the shadows, there's all sorts of corruptness.
And so probably all human organization, in a sense. I mean,
yeah, I agree. You know, yeah, that's why God's opposed to them, wants us to disassociate from human institutions. And you go from that to Eastern meditation, which is personal and not the absolute antithesis of the group. Performance of being a Lutheran, collective experience of being a Lutheran, to Eastern meditation, which is so personal, and the antithesis of pomp and ceremony. So that's a pretty knee jerk extreme. And then go to the Pentecostals. Oh my goodness! Hey, do you ever think as a Pentecostal that you were actually making sense when you were blathering?
I never really totally got into, like, I never totally grasped the whole thing with the speaking in tongues thing.
Yeah.
The idea of that being normative, was a problem.
By the way, it's just so absurd, this whole concept of speaking in tongues. You know, you use your tongue to speak. Without your tongue, you cannot create a different palette of sounds. I mean, sounds and words that are spoken verbally are a combination of your mouth position, open or closed, your lips and how they are positioned, and your tongue. And that really is. And you know, you can also change the shape of your vocal cords, but the combination of those things is what creates a sound that we can understand in terms of words. And so this idea of speaking in tongues as if tongue was a language.
Tongue does mean language. Then, you know, I mean, and it's a word in the English language that means language. When you speak the Greek tongue or the Latin tongue, that is one of the denotations of tongue is a language.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a whole science surrounding the making of the sound called articulatory phonetics.
But the Hebrew tongue, the Greek tongue, the English tongue as a language, you've modified tongue to say that we're training the tongue to make sounds of the English language, just to say you're speaking in tongues.
It's like speaking in tongues means speaking in languages, heavenly languages.
But there's only one heavenly language, it's Hebrew. And no one who is speaking in tongues is actually speaking Hebrew. I mean, it's utter nonsense. I mean, every Pentecostal out there is fooling themselves and fooling others. I mean, it's a con.
It's a tricky thing. Actually, if you're going after Paul alludes specifically to the phenomenon. Yes. So If you're going after Paul, you go after that.
Oh, of course. It's completely and totally Pauline. It's another one of Paul's lies. Because the experience that's discussed in early Acts, because the first like 8 or 9 chapters of Acts are actually based on Shimon Kephish as Peter's testimony, have nothing to do with Paul. Paul comes in after chapter 9 of Acts. So when the set apart spirit came upon those who had lived through and observed Pesach with Yahusha, and observed Matzah and Vakodim with Yahusha, the spirit, the set-apart spirit, came upon them in fulfillment of Shavua, of the promise of sevens. Right. And when that occurred, they did not speak in tongues in terms of heavenly languages. The description is really clear. Oh, absolutely. To the those living in Arabia, they spoke Arabian. To those living in Persia, they would speak Akkadian. To to those in every community in Phoenicia, they spoke Phoenician. I mean, and it differentiates the cultures, the Greek culture, for example, and Rome and the Latin culture, and it says they spoke the language of those people. They were empowered to communicate the word of Yahweh in the languages that people understood. And
it's almost the reverse Tower of Babel type thing, in the sense that at the Tower of Babel, the languages were confused. In this case, God put His truth into the languages.
Correct. That's why I'm so comfortable translating Hebrew into English and teaching and talking in English, because that is the skill set that the set apart spirit has provided, this ability to translate something from the Hebrew into the languages that people understand and speak. It is what we're empowered to do. But that whole concept, that Pauline concept of, speaking in tongues, if I speak in the tongues of angels and in men,
angels,
and the fact is that there's no such thing as an angel. They are Malach messengers, and the language that they speak is Hebrew. They don't speak any language other than Hebrew. If you don't like Hebrew, and a lot of people say, I don't have to learn Hebrew. If you don't like to learn Hebrew, you are stunting your ability to understand who Yahweh is and what He says. And B, you are saying that I don't want to speak a language that is the only language that's going to be spoken in heaven. Now, why would you even want to go there if you don't like the language?
Yeah, well, it's so funny, because I can imagine that the Hebrew spoken on earth right now is a bit off. I imagine some of the Hebrew.
Oh, not a bit. A lot. For example, there is no V in Hebrew. And yet, you think of all of the Hebrew words now that they have added the V sound to them. In Hebrew now, if you write the waw, the W, well, it was originally pronounced O. Now you'll find it pronounced as if it was a V, sometimes even a B. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we jump back in and detail more from Paul's poison pen and come to understand why Pauline Christianity is unreliable, why Paul is a liar, we were really talking about Glenn's past and the fact that Glenn journeyed, as many of us have, out of Christianity into the covenant with Yahweh, that I would say that the majority of those that I correspond to regularly, Glenn, on the in email, came out of Roman Catholicism and recognized that religion is way whacked out. I mean, that they're just so many ridiculous flaws in Roman Catholicism that anybody who is the least bit informed and rational is going to leave it. You have to be either ignorant and or irrational or both to be a Roman Catholic. And that Protestant Christianity, while it is less obviously wrong, it's still based on Paul's letters, and Paul lied. I mean, everything Paul said is untrue. So, it's a journey that many of us have been on, out of one form or another of Christianity. And your turn just took you through one bend that has become more popular in America. In fact, as I was driving east and I was making my way through, I believe it was Tennessee, not too far from Nashville, on the northern side of Interstate 40, there was a Pentecostal church that looked grander than almost any building in Washington, D.C. I mean, it was done Greek Revival, full Palladian architecture, and ornate and gargantuan. I mean, the buildings had to be in the many tens of millions of dollars to build, and it was Pentecostal. And so my sense is that that since their words make no sense, that this idea of muttering senseless words is appealing.
Well, and if you were near Cleveland, Tennessee, my guess would be it's that church is probably affiliated with one of the Churches of God. There are several different Churches of God. One's the Church of God of Prophecy, and like they actually think that they are the church, much as the Roman Catholic Church thinks that they are the church, which is kind of a fascinating thing for a tiny little Pentecostal denomination. But as to the
Mormons think that they are the church. The Seventh-day Adventists think they are the church. Jehovah's Witnesses think they are the church. The Copts in Egypt think they are the church. And all the various Eastern Orthodox churches all independently think that they are the church. So there's a lot of that going around.
Well, what's interesting, what the Catholics will tell you is their official doctrine is that if you're not part of them, there is no salvation for you. But they de-emphasize that, they hide that. Now, the Church of God of Prophecy, though it's the church, at least they're a little more magnanimous, and they consider you part of the kingdom, but not really part of the church. So, in the heavenly...
You know what's so amazing about this is that all of these organizations are called churches. And
which
yet there's not.
Yeah,
I know. And there isn't a simple. There isn't even any word even remotely related to church, even in the Greek Christian New Testament. I mean, there isn't a word. The Torah, prophets, and Psalms, of course, have no church because church is named Shirshe, the daughter of Helios in the Germanic pagan religion.
It was a mockery, and they embraced it. If you go in there, they'll turn you into pigs. But then they turned and embraced it, you know.
Yeah, it's very much like Christian. You know, Christian appears twice, I believe, in Acts, and it was an epithet. It was a term used to negatively describe the religious individuals.
Drugs.
Yeah, it means it means to apply drugs, right?
Yeah
it's a terrible term.
But they embraced it. Same thing as Godspell. They cast the Godspell on people. It's a mockery.
Of course.
They embraced it.
Yeah, it's got the spell of Got. Got is a Teutonic word for the Helios, the sun god, and spell is a demonic spell that is an utterance that's supposed to have magic powers. You're right. I mean, no matter where you turn, they've built human edifices and empires out of extraordinarily negative things, and church happens to be one of them. There is no word even remotely akin to church in the Greek context. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Having a conversation here with Glenn about his voyage. Glenn, I understand that you were dissatisfied with Lutheranism. Chose to dabble in Eastern meditation. What was it about the Lutheran variation of Protestant Christianity, and it's as Catholic as and Orthodox as you can be and still be on the Protestant side of things, but what was it that was the most troubling aspect of it for you?
Well, it's sort of the it was a social organization. It was a habitual thing to go to. Were people in the various group or disagree, but there wasn't much of anything of substance of really taking a stand for something, knowing what you believe, and having it being a life guiding worldview or anything like that, and lacking in substance. So it's the similarity between the Eastern going east. I mean, you had in the 70s, a lot of people either had the famous Harvey Cox book, The Turning East, about people writing books about the East, people going, you had the Mahesh Yogi and the Beatles, you had Mount Long Imagination, all that stuff.
Yes.
Why did people turn east? They were looking for experience. They weren't satisfied with their experience, and they were looking for something experiential. And even, I would say, my return to Pentecostalism was it's just an extension of the experiential aspect. It's okay, well, wait a minute, over here in Christianity, you have something that's Christian but experiential, so it's all about...
So I was correct in saying that the Lutheran experience, which is so orthodox and so into a sense of belonging and a sense of protocol and community and ritual, but there's no teaching. And part of the reason there's no teaching is there's nothing they can teach that makes any sense. So the no teaching, and so for somebody who was interested in growing and learning, there's no way to grow and learn in that kind of an environment. And so then you were saying, okay, I have a hunger. I don't see anybody out there that's teaching that can stimulate my brain. So since so many people who are considered enlightened are turning east, maybe the personal stimuli, the experience of that will somehow be satisfying. But, of course, there really isn't any knowledge input that comes from meditation.
Emptying your mind.
right. Empty your mind as opposed to filling your mind. And so from there you went to an extension of that, which was let's talk gibberish.
And there's more, a lot more to it than that, actually. Like in Pentecostal, okay. And I tread lightly. I don't launch into excoriating, because first of all, just having been in various places myself, for people who are outside, you know, and don't know anything about Yahweh or Covenant, I'm not into excoriating rebukes, because you never know who's going to turn. Like you say, who would think Mennonites would come over, you know, as indoctrinated as they were. So I know myself, having, you know, been down enough, blind alleys, I don't excoriate those who are presently in those places.
There's a difference, though. It's kind of like Prophet of Doom. Prophet of Doom excoriates Islam, not Muslims. The whole idea is that I do wish to make a distinction between demonstrating with evidence and reason that Paul lied, and therefore the basis of Christianity, no matter which form, is unfounded and unreliable. It's not to say that we don't want to be open to Christians who have an open mind and who are interested in knowing the truth. Absolutely want to keep an open door to Christians, because most people who come to the covenant come from one of two places. They're either secular Jews, and the majority of Jews today are secular. They're not religious, so they're typically agnostics. And if they're not, if they're kind of shadow the agnostic, most secular Jews actually know there's a God. They don't know him personally. They know that he can't be found through Judaism. They have no affinity for Judaism at all, but they still identify with being Jewish as a race and now as a nationality in Israeli.
Right.
And they're typically well-educated. I mean, we're stereotyping here, but, you know, more than the average are well-educated, open-minded, and thoughtful. And I would say they are the most receptive to what Yahweh has to say. And second on to them are those who have grown up in the politically correct environment of American or Western education, who realize that there are internal fallacies there that don't make any sense, but still appreciate the underlying pinnings of education, which is evidence and reason. And they come out of that experience as an agnostic, but not as an atheist, because an atheist takes too much faith, it's too much work. They come out of it as an open-minded, thoughtful agnostic that says, you know, if somebody can actually show me something that's mentally satisfying, you know, I'd like to know more than I currently know. And so I would say they're the second most open to what Yahweh has to say. And the third most open are questioning Christians. Those who have been Christians and have realized, oh man, there's just so much of this that is senseless. Like, how does man kill God? And how does killing God somehow fix something? And if God were killed and he was bodily resurrected, why is, if bodies are flawed, why would he be resurrected in a flawed body? And why didn't anybody recognize him when he was resurrected? And why in Christianity are they meeting on Sundays when the God they claim inspired their scriptures spoke of the Sabbath? You know, there's just conflicts.
There are a lot of things like if you get a bunch of people sitting down around a table or with some time to kick things around. You know, I personally think a lot of Christians, or even maybe even theologians, once you start to get into these metaphysically or trickier aspects of Yahweh's manifestations as the Ruach Kodesh or as Yahweh as a Messiah, may not disagree with what you're saying about the idea of the Ruach Kodesh being a set apart manifestation and Yahusha bodily being a set apart, diminished manifestation.
Right.
Those things aren't utterly incompatible with a Trinitarian, someone who's got this Trinitarian idea, because you do have Yahweh, and it's this manifest, diminished set apart manifestation as the Ruach Kodesh, and the set apart.
Yeah.
So that there's three different things there. They're going to want to that group can make
their issue, of course, would be the Trinity is typically defined as three persons. And three distinct persons, then God's answers are in wholesale conflict with that. So you can't rationally get to three persons with one individual manifesting himself in two different ways. So, but you're right. There are aspects of what God has to say that are in conflict with Christianity that yet a rational Christian would say, I'm okay with this idea that the totality of God wasn't in Yahusha, that I understand that he has to be set apart twice. I understand that general concept of spirit to matter, and I understand that he's a diminished manifestation, that he can't be, that Paul said the totality of the Godhead, that's not possible. And that he is, as he claimed to be, a diminished manifestation. I say, that's in conflict with Christian doctrine, but I wouldn't argue that point, and that his name isn't Jesus Christ, that Christ isn't a last name, that he didn't have a Greek name, that he didn't have a last name, and that his first name most certainly wasn't Jesus. And I would agree with you there, but they'll never embrace it.
The question is, even if you understand it, it's like, okay, how, like, I dialogue regularly with Christian friends about this. It's like, hey, why is it okay to continually call the Messiah by the incorrect name? If you have the book of Joshua in the Old Testament, why are you calling the Messiah Jesus in the New Testament when the name is far closer to Joshua than it is to Jesus?
Right. And of course, it isn't actually Joshua, because there was no J. There is no J in Hebrew.
And I get that too, yeah. Closer.
You're right. And then once you come to the point where you know his name, not only that, if you say that you have a relationship with someone and you've come to know their actual name, then there is no justification whatsoever with using a wrong name that's not even close, that has nothing in common. But once you actually know his name, it changes everything. Because what it tells you is it tells you that individual is irrelevant. It tells you that the individual that's relevant is Yahweh. Absolutely.
Right.
It's Yahweh saved, so the relevant individual is Yahweh, and that's what the name means. And so the religion of Christianity goes poof, even for those who have been beguiled into believing that the religion of Christianity was created by their Jesus, even when they learn his correct name, and they know that it is now Yahusha, the moment you understand what Yahusha means, that Yahweh saves, then you can't cling to this idea that that he's relevant, because he's not.
Well, a Hindu would have much less trouble with your articulation of the nature of Yahusha's manifestation as the Messiah than a Christian would. Because, like in Hinduism, the whole idea is to get the guru out of the way to have the real experience, right?
Right.
Like the guru is just, and I'm not equating Yahusha to a guru, but believe me, that's been done gazillions of times anyway.
Right.
But the point is, a Hindu would be more receptive to grasping
The difficulty with the Hindu, though, will fall into a willingness to embrace concepts that are in opposition with one another. So the Hindu could say, yes, I understand the set apart and diminished manifestation of Yahweh, and have no problem using that name or understanding that Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh set apart from him. They will also include in what they will accept many things that are contrary to that. So it's a yes and a no in regard to that argument.
Not a problem.
Welcome back to the last segment of Shattering Myths for today. We've got Glenn on the line, and we've actually been talking about Glenn's journey through life, because it's really interesting for all of us as to how in the world do we leave the world of human schemes and human institutions and ultimately reject that and come to know Yahweh and participate in the covenant. Glenn, as you talk to Christians, I would say that, at least my assessment, is that for someone to come to know Yahweh and to engage in the covenant, the following needs to be true. They have to want to know the truth sufficiently to be willing to invest considerable time to learn the truth, and then have to be willing to reject lies as they are proven false by the truth, and to go to where the words lead. And it's a combination, really, of three things. You know, are you willing to let go of things that you have believed when they're shown not to be true? Are you willing to go to where the words lead when they lead in a direction different than what you were anticipating? And are you willing to invest the time to know the truth? I think you have to have all three of those things. What do you think?
Yes, but especially, and what I'm thinking is, this involves basically intellectual process, understanding logic. You know,
correct.
No contradiction. You know, law. Correct. You know, law of non-contradiction. Okay,
correct.
You're talking about a pretty. In other words, yes, we're responsible, to seek the truth and to follow it. I'm thinking of how easy it is to be ignorant.
This sounds like God's
putting together an Ivy League institution or an Air Force Academy or West Point many are called, but few are chosen. Maybe, the few, the rightly indoctrinated, and maybe you can be one of us if you put out enough effort.
Let me respond to that. Being open-minded in the terms of being willing to trust that which proves to be trustworthy in the case of Yahweh's testimony does not necessarily require someone to be resolutely rational and brilliant in terms of being able to process information. That said, I will tell you that the vast preponderance of those that I have come to know that have engaged in the covenant are very smart individuals. Now, that being the case, I want to address this from Yahweh's perspective. Yahweh's pretty darn smart. And he is going to be spending all eternity with a very select number of people. One in a million on average. And eternity is a very long time. And while Yahweh can give any of us the ability to be more discerning, more rational, and to think more clearly and to think faster than we currently do, I would not think less of Yahweh to say that he has a preference for the Dodes of the world, for David, who I think is the single most brilliant human to have ever lived. I'm not opposed to the idea that he is prone to enjoy the company of people who think rationally and clearly. Now, that said, I've read, as you've read, Abraham's responses to Yahweh and his conversations with Yahweh. And I'm going to tell you, Abraham, based upon his responses alone, is not the smartest guy in the world. He just is not that smart. Dode is brilliant, to David. I mean, he is just mind-blowingly brilliant to the point when I read what he wrote, I mean, I'm just humbled and I said, whoa, that man, he is so much smarter than I am. But that's not the case with Abraham. And by the way, when I read Moshe, I read brilliance. I read this guy flat out got it, and he could synthesize it, and he could communicate it. But, you know, so I do think there is a broader swath than just brilliant. But I don't hold it against God to say that he wants to spend eternity with people who like to think, who enjoy thinking, who think clearly. Not the worst idea in the world. Glenn, I've enjoyed our whole conversation over this last hour in change, and I look forward to being with you all tomorrow. May God bless.